Now, from the left coast to the D.C. Beltway, covering the topics you love to hate and hate to miss, it's the Silk or Joe Show.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Silk or Joe Show. Co-host Joe with you all here today. Glad to be with you all here this afternoon. So, coming to you here, before I get to this guest that we have waiting on standby, I got to rush through this introduction of this program first, of course. But the Silk or Joe Show is brought to you by the Main Street Radio Network, so we want to thank them for allowing this program to exist. Sometimes management doesn't like the content, but you know what? They have our backs. We appreciate that. We also want to thank the Main Street. We also want to thank the Salem Radio Network for distributing this show. But then I go on to the Main Street Radio Network's website at mainstreetradionetwork.com. And that is what I was trying to say a second ago when I instead meant to thank the Salem Radio Network for distributing this show. Now, at mainstreetradionetwork.com, you can find previous podcasts of this program. And I try to say that 10 times fast. Previous podcasts of this program. And you can also find the sister show, The Alan Nathan Show, up there as well. Now, The Alan Nathan Show has its own website, alannathan.com, but The Silk or Joe Show, we are limited to mainstreetradionetwork.com. But, you know, it's a good thing, I guess, because this show, it's had three names over the course of its life. It's been around for over 10 years now. We're in our 11th year. So, you know, if you bought the domain name for the original website, well, gee whiz, you're out of luck when you change the name the first time, let alone the second time. We also are on social media, though, Main Street Radio Network's pages. We usually use those at Facebook at Main Street Radio Network, Twitter at Main Street Radio, Wimkin, W-I-M-K-I-N, at Main Street Radio Network. But then we also have our own page on Getter, G-E-T-T-R.com, at Silk or Joe Show. All right, now our current guest's been waiting in the wings here while I got through all that. We have Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he previously was a senior writer for the Washington Examiner and Washington correspondent for Investors Business Daily. Sean Higgins, happy to have you on the show. How are you today?
Thanks for having me. Feeling good.
All right, glad to have you. So this topic that we're getting into about the Biden administration's latest labor rule on independent contractors, you know, it hits me kind of personally. Sometimes maybe I'm not a little as responsible as I like to be with my spending, so I go in DoorDash, which risks me becoming a headline. Local radio host found dead in this section of town because of a very dissatisfied customer, perhaps. However, it's still a good thing to have on hand, on standby, just in case. But what are these new rules that are making it harder for people to do this kind of work?
Precisely what you described. I mean, it's going to make those type of side hustles a lot harder for people to have and to hold on to. Because essentially what the law does is says that the companies like DoorDash have to have regular employees and can't sort of, you know, do the sort of piece off of the piecemeal work that you were doing on occasion, which is the basis of the economy model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly it's very helpful to be able to have, for the sake of having two jobs, you know, you don't have this full-time job with the second one like delivering food, and you can just do it at hours that are convenient for you. Like for me, I don't need a second full-time job. I just need to do like 2 hours a day for a week or something, and I'm all set, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are jobs that are done largely by people who, you know, just need a few extra bucks to be able to make sure they get the rent and be able to pay for groceries this month, that type of stuff. And it's the rise of those type of jobs and that type of work that basically caused this rule, because they're being pushed by a lot of unions and other groups to try and force those companies to stop using this type of contract labor, which is harder to organize, and to hire regular employees instead. And, you know, there are cases where some of these employers do abuse the distinction between contractors and employees, but this is a sort of baby with the bathwater problem. They're going to cause a lot of trouble for a lot of people who do freelance work if they actually aggressively try to enforce this rule.
Well, yeah, because then, you know, you have to, like you said, get a full-time job with the group. You don't want to do that. Or then you got to join a union as well and pay all these dues and stuff. And it's like, but I'm only doing this because I need, like, an extra $200 before the end of the month to make rent or something like that. You know, you don't need to do it, take a hunk of that $200 just to pay off some union or whatever. But then, as you said, though, there are some people who do it full-time where they have issues as well. But, like, truly, there's something better than what the Biden administration is doing.
One of the suggestions that's been floated around is to allow workers to sort of voluntarily designate themselves as contractors and, you know, sort of circumvent this whole issue. But this rule very explicitly prevents workers from being able to do that. It's strictly up to the regulators as to what an employment relationship is. Not the worker doesn't have any say in this.
Now, how does this rule change things that were done earlier? Because the Biden administration back in 2021, they had a kind of regulation that they issued, but I guess the unions pressured them, especially during an election year, they caved to change that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about this is that there isn't actually a clear definition of what an employer is under federal law. There's basically a test where they have several different factors, and no one factor is determinative, no combination of factors is determinative. Originally, there were five different factors. The Trump administration came out with a rule that narrowed it down to just two, the degree of control the worker has over the situation and whether they are incurring any actual economic risk. In other words, if you do something for DoorDash, it's entirely possible that you might not make as much money from that as you would expend in gas for your car or something like that. That situation can emerge. That's the type of situation that would sort of determine it. But this current Biden rule basically goes back to the five-factor rule and adds another factor. And none of those factors are determinative. So it's very incredibly vague as to what the definition of an employer or a freelancer is under this rule. And it's basically just left up to the regulators on a case-by-case basis, which is real trouble for businesses because they don't know they're not going to know until they get sued whether or not what they're doing is legal or not.
That's certainly not a way to run a railroad here. Surely the Biden administration is aware of that issue there and the stifling effect this will have on businesses, because people will be like, well, wait a minute, I don't know if I'm going to get sued or not by doing this. Maybe I just won't do it. And all these people who need this extra income, well, too bad, so sad. Guess you're not going to make it to the end of the month, or guess you're not going to be able to have a nice holiday shopping spree there from the money that you made from this.
I'm not sure that they necessarily do know. I mean, from talking to regulators and hearing them testify before congressional committees, they just seem to have a different view of this. One of the things you have to understand is that freelance work for the longest time was, you know, sort of ghettoized, for lack of a better phrase I can think of, into particular professions. I mean, you would hear about it for, like, you know, freelance journalists, freelance photographer, actors were for the most part freelance, although they do have unions. But most other sort of jobs and work were regular jobs. The concept of a sort of gig economy model didn't really come until the internet came along. It took a while for that to happen. So this is a sort of new phenomenon, and we're still sort of feeling our way through it. And that's part of the reason why we're having this rule, is it's the sort of do something thinking on the part of the government. And they're just sort of, well, we'll put this rule out there and see if it works and then go from there.
So then there is a chance, perhaps when the unions aren't in a position to put so much pressure, like perhaps at the end of this year or after the elections are all done, that we'll see a retraction in these rules if it turns out there's enough backlash to them.
Well, they're definitely going to be challenged in court. Groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the International Franchise Association and a lot of other trade groups are going to say this just isn't fair. Part of the responsibility of the federal government is to put clear rules out so the actors know what to do. And if a court says this doesn't make any sense, how is somebody supposed to follow along with this? Then that can be a factor, and they may be forced to make changes to the rule that way. There's also legislative efforts afoot. There's a congressional CRA effort to sort of roll this back that will probably fail because it's not going to get through the Senate. But it's a sign that there's a lot of other people who are saying this doesn't make any sense. We can do better.
So there are people out there fighting on behalf of the gig works and the workers in the gig economy. That's good to hear.
Yes.
And, you know, especially for the people who actually need it, as opposed to me, who just does it for on occasion. But, you know,
this is the type of thing that can cut across party lines, too. I mean, there are a lot of people who do actually hear from, you know, people back in their districts who might otherwise be, like, really liberal, who say, look, this isn't working for us. Please change it. I mean, when they tried this, something similar in California under the AB 5 law, there's a strong backlash because there's a lot of freelance contract workers out there who suddenly found themselves stuck under this rule and lost a lot of business as a consequence, and they got quite angry.
Mm-hmm. I thought I recalled hearing about that sort of thing happening in California. And, you know, I didn't want to get into the politics of it with left versus right or anything, but yeah, you're absolutely right. There is definitely a bipartisan way through this. And, you know, perhaps if the Biden administration overstepped here, maybe they can find some solution that might even be satisfactory to unions.
You know, it's possible. Certainly, it, you know, some sitting down and trying to work something out together is better than, you know, a sort of sweeping rulemaking like this. I mean, one of the problems is that, you know, we just don't see this type of bipartisan work in Congress anymore, which is unfortunate because this is one of those issues where there is sort of common ground that you think that they put their heads together, they could come up with a better something. Certainly, if we could come up with an actual clear definition of what an employer is, that would be nice.
Yeah, you just don't want to leave it to the regulators in the Biden administration or any other administration for that matter to come up with their own work rules. I mean, that's not even how representative government is supposed to work, right? Where an unelected bureaucrat does the rules, you get the final word on this. And then go ahead.
Idle hands are the devil's work. True then, it's true now.
All right. Well, Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, appreciate you being on the Silker Joe Show. Folks, we have more show coming up after this break, so stick with us.
Wine Country by rising country star Hannah Ellis. After 10 years of carving out her own space in Music City, the Kentucky native now introduces her debut album, That Girl, available now. Named by Rolling Stone Country as an artist to watch and a CMT Listen Up artist, Hannah Ellis has appeared on the Grand Ole Opry several times and toured with stars such as Billy Currington, Gavin DeGraw, and Carly Pierce. That Girl reveals a seasoned songwriter embracing her small-town roots, her real-life romance, and her relatable artistic voice. Hannah Ellis told us about the inspiration for the new album.
The heart of country music is storytelling. Life itself is the inspiration behind this record. Whether it's my sister's breakup, my insecurities, or falling in love, I'm just living my life with a pen and a microphone.
That Girl is now available wherever you get music. For more, visit HannahEllisMusic.com.
From debut author Carolina Ixta comes an unforgettable new young adult novel, Shut Up, This Is Serious, tells the story of two Latina girls growing up in East Oakland, who face a world full of messy complexities as they try to navigate their high school years. Belen wants the normal teen stuff, to hang out with friends, experience love, or maybe even have a boyfriend. But nothing is normal in her East Oakland community. Her father left her family. She's at risk of not graduating. And Letty, her religious best friend, is pregnant by the boyfriend she hasn't told her parents about. Weighed by a depression she can't seem to shake, Belen sees her other classmates getting ready for college. But what future is there for girls like her? Author Carolina Ixta.
Shut Up, This Is Serious deals with topics such as racism, generational trauma, and teen pregnancies, though it's also about the fierce and intimate uplifting power of friendship and chosen family.
Shut Up, This Is Serious is now available wherever books are sold.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover guitar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Adopt US Kids for multiple choice parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give him a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve, it's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Silker Joe Show, everybody. Co-host Joe with you all here today. And we are joined by a guest in this segment as well, M.K. Sweeney. In her spare time from working as a senior counsel for a global chemical company, she writes fiction such as her new book, The Mage of Miriam, The Boy Who Saved the Kingdom. M.K. Sweeney, happy to have you on the show. How are you today?
Hi, Joseph. I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, glad to have you. So tell us about your new book.
So it's The Magi of Miriam, The Boy Who Saved the Kingdom. And this book is the first in a series of Christian middle grade fantasy books. And it's a fast-paced action and adventure with a lot of humor thrown in, because I think that everybody loves humor. I mean, what else gets us through?
Right.
But the underlying crux of the story, and like I said, this is the first in the series, is a glorification of God book. So it's a book for to be accessible for kids, but adults like it too. And it's told in a very engaging way, but it is... if the reader comes away with the questions as to what would a relationship with God look like for me, and if they overcome some insecurities and have a little bit of moral grounding, then I will have done a really great job with this book.
Now, you mentioned this is the first in a series, but is this your first book?
This is my first long-form fiction book. So as you mentioned, I am senior counsel for a chemical company. I have written quite a lot of legal things. But as far as writing fiction, you know, writing something that somebody wants to pick up for fun, this is the first. And so far, I think that I and the publisher have been really pleasantly surprised at how well it's been received by kids and their families. And it is also on Audible. The Audible was recorded by a guy with a much more fun, engaging voice than me. And so that kind of brings it to life as well. And people have enjoyed interacting with it that way also.
Okay. So then, actually, I might as well ask, hearing it in Audible with his voice, did that change the way that you were thinking about the story? Because hitherto, you'd been writing it with your own voice in your head, or talking about it to yourself. I don't know how you read, but then now you're hearing it in someone else's voice entirely. I'm sure that made some change into your perception of it.
Yeah, it's such a good question. That's a really fun question, especially with someone on the radio has got a nice voice himself. So,
oh,
yeah, you're welcome. It did, in that, like, some of the voices that this guy does, and he's got, like, the Johnny Depp voice, right? Like, he can throw his voice, and he does different voices for different characters. And, I mean, like Robin Williams, he can just change his voice depending upon who is talking, whether it's female or male. And, I mean, it was just so stinking funny. So he did some of the characters, and I mean, there's like, so this is like a cataclysmic good and evil battle, right, book. There's parts, and it's the protagonist, this 12-year-old boy, and then his cousin, who's a 14-year-old, very strong female character. And there's like some nemesis in the book, right? And so the narrator, the Audible reader, he read some of these characters that were like the evil guys, in this kind of like Brooklyn mob voice, which just, I mean, cracked me up. So I would say that hearing the Audible as it was produced was for me personally, was one of the most rewarding aspects to this whole process. I mean, I just loved it.
Now, were any of those recurring characters that you heard where suddenly hearing them with that voice, that's going to kind of maybe even subconsciously, if not overtly consciously, impact your characterization of them for the sequels?
So probably not, just because I lived and breathed this book for 6 years before it was released and published. And then the Audible itself was, I don't know if you've had interaction with Audible, but it also is quite a slow process. So I don't think that the Audible will really have an impact on me. I think it would have a lot of impact. And I have started to have some early conversations about optioning the material and rights. I think it would have a lot of impact on if a film was produced. So probably not on me as the writer, but probably definitely it would have some impact if it's made into a film on whoever would write the screenplay.
All right. So what inspired the story initially? I guess you just needed some creative outlet. You're sitting there writing all them legal briefs and you're like, and then you find yourself going into fiction on them because, well, I mean, let's face
it. So boring,
sometimes
I went into fiction. Oh, that's funny. That's a funny thought. So we have three young kids, my husband and I, and the genesis of this book was more along the lines of I just wasn't finding stuff that I really thought was worthwhile to give them to read. And contemporary times, I don't know if you have found this, but I was finding that a lot of the books for kids and a lot of the shows and whatnot kind of had pretty focused agendas that I just didn't really love. And so I wanted to give, this book in the series, it's a traditional book that, you know, along the lines of C.S. Lewis meeting Hunger Games. It used to be kind of available, but sort of has fallen out of more contemporary times for various reasons. And I wanted it to be presented as an alternative for not only my kids, but for other families as well.
So sort of a case of if someone else can't do it, I guess you have to step up and do it yourself. It's pretty good motivation there, actually. If you can't find the fiction that you want, the stories that you want for your kids, well, just tell it to them yourselves. It's pretty good.
Yeah. I think that's true. With my writing, you're spot on, but also just for all of us in general, if we're not going to stand up for and speak to the things that we find important to us, nobody else will. I mean, we have to engage for ourselves. We need to, and we owe it to ourselves and the individuals around us to do that. And so that's exactly right. You hit it on the head.
So I guess one other thing, though, since you came into this as a lawyer already, you were kind of ready to handle all the copyright stuff. Maybe you had a class on in law school, or at least you were some basic familiar with the law, or did it just hit you as something entirely new?
The IP aspect. So, no, that was not new. And, a chemical company has a lot of IP. We have R&D centers for the global company that I work with. I have a lot of familiarity with that aspect. The publishing industry in general is new to me. And so understanding that and how books are released and how they get placed in book fairs and stores, and then Amazon has been such a disruptor. You can say good or bad, but it's been such a disruptor to the publishing industry, and then, literary agents and all of the different aspects of publishing. They are all new to me, and that is certainly an industry that I am starting to learn to speak the language on and had no familiarity with previously. And the entertainment industry in general is all new to me. I'm on this. I didn't even realize, spots like this were called hits until fairly recently when you get booked on television and radio and things like that. So all of that has been, I've had to learn quite quickly.
So then what would you say the most, well, you got about less than a minute left here, so what would you say the most surprising thing you learned during all this was?
Oh, my goodness. I guess how slow the publishing industry works. I mean, it is like at glacial building speed. I just had no idea. And I tend not to be the most patient person. That's something I need to work on, but it's very, very slow. And so that, and then also at just what a interesting metamorphosis is going through more recently with Amazon and all of these different things versus traditional publishing. And this book was traditionally published, but that's been quite interesting. And I do want to say people can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere. And the Audible is on Audible.
All right, M.K. Sweeney, thank you very much. And listeners, again, it's called The Magi of Miriam, The Boy Who Saved the Kingdom. More show after this break.
It's become an annual headache for retailers. After the Christmas shopping frenzy, what to do with a post-holiday wave of customer returns? Last year, US retailers spent more than $7 billion processing returned items. But new research has found that providing more personalized shopping options could protect retailers against losing money in 2024 by reducing the volume of returns and essentially reducing waste. Here to tell us more about this is Megan Hostetler, Director of Product Marketing at SAP and Marsys Customer Engagement.
Our research found that over half, that's 54% of consumers, do their absolute best to avoid retailers that charge to return an item. We know this is an ever-occurring problem. And for me as a consumer, if we receive a more tailored and personalized customer experience, the volume of these returns will drop. This research by SAP Amarsys Customer Engagement will launch at NRF in 2024. To learn more, visit amarsys.com/NRF.
CES is always a proving ground for breakthrough technologies and global innovators, and I'm working with some great brands to share the latest and greatest. The S8 Max V Ultra from Roborock is redefining how we clean our homes. The deep cleaning capabilities and self-maintenance features make cleaning more convenient. Online protection experts McAfee have unveiled their new AI-powered deepfake audio detection technology. Known as Project Mockingbird, this technology will be a reliable resource for consumers amidst the rise of malicious AI-generated material online. Tonies are a great screen-free educational toy option for children. Pop any of the Tonies on top of the Tony box and they'll play a variety of stories, songs, and lessons that can develop children's emotional intelligence with age-appropriate tech. The X-Real Air 2 Pro AR glasses are a great option for gaming, working at a desk, or incorporating augmented reality apps into your day-to-day life. And because they look like normal sunglasses, they'll fit right into your pocket and blend seamlessly into your day. For more, check out stephaniehumphrey.com.
I was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean when it happened. There was a sudden jolt and our submarine crashed on the seafloor. We were in total darkness.
That's Dr. Dejana Figueroa, a marine biologist and STEM teacher, talking about a deep sea dive she'll never forget.
It's funny. When I was a kid, I was afraid of the ocean. And there I was, 2 miles below the surface. But as a scientist, you prepare for that. Using our training and a little creativity, we fixed the sub and finished our experiments. The dive was just too important. Every dive gives us glimpses at things few people ever get to see. Glowing creatures, fiery undersea volcanoes. When we got back to the surface, I kissed the ground and called my mom, of course. But you know what? I wouldn't trade that dive for anything.
Dr. Figueroa uses her passion for STEM to discover new things and make the world a better place. She can STEM, so can you. Check out She Can STEM for more stories and inspiration. A message from the Ad Council.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm gonna keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart and don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
This is David Cordani, CEO of Cigna. For more than 20 years, Cigna has worked with the March of Dimes to address premature births in the U.S. Premature births cause horrible suffering and cost billions of dollars each year. That's why Cigna is committed to raising funds and awareness through our employees, family, and friends to improve the health of moms and babies. Please join us in supporting the March for Babies. Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
The March of Dimes and HCA Healthcare are committed to the best possible start for every baby. I'm Amy Casseri, Vice President of HCA Women and Children's Services, where we have the honor of delivering over 200,000 babies a year. We partner with the March of Dimes on research and fundraising to help build a brighter future for babies everywhere. So march with us on one of the many HCA teams assembled nationwide. Learn more at marchforbabies.org/HCA.
I've spent more time in the Bethel AME Church in Wilmington, Delaware than I have than most people I know, black or white, have spent in that church. Because that's why I started the Civil... No, I'm serious. I started the Civil Rights Movement.
Welcome back to the Silker Joe Show, everybody, where President Biden just admitted that he is the one who started the Civil Rights Movement. He was speaking at an African Methodist Episcopal church in South Carolina. Didn't mean to put odd enunciation on that. I was trying to make sure I pronounced it correctly. And he was saying how that he spent more time at the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Delaware. And, you know, what's slowing me down is I keep wanting to say African American Methodist Episcopal Church, but then, you know, the word American isn't in there. It's just that my failing vision makes it look like that it should be. Anyway, though, so yeah, he's saying he spent more time in the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Delaware than anybody he knows, and that he started the civil rights movement there. It's a, well, he goes along with his other claims. Why did they bounce George Santos out of Congress when Joe Biden is going around saying he started the civil rights movement? I'm pretty sure one lie is a bit more significant than anything that Santos was accused of saying. But if you check out the White House's official transcript of the situation, well, don't believe your lying ears. Joe Biden didn't say anything of the kind. They just said that it doesn't say he started the civil rights movement. They added a couple of words there to say, like, he started with the civil rights movement there or something like that. But that's another lie, because Joe Biden is the one who was saying that our schools would be racial jungles if they were desegregated. So even if, so it's like he's lying about the lie that he's been telling. That's basically what we're hearing. First, he lies that he was with the civil rights movement. He wasn't. He was opposed to it. He's the one who coined the phrase racial jungles. But then on top of that, top trying to bury that history, now he's saying, oh, well, you know what? It wasn't just that I started with the civil rights movement early. Don't believe what I said later on. Rather, believe that I was with them all the way. I don't know, marched with Martin Luther King Jr. He probably said that at some point. But now he actually started it. I guess he's the one who said, hey, Martin, did you ever have a dream? I bet you he's going to say that next. Just watch it. Because he is losing support in the African-American community and every other non-white community out there. In fact, Alan Nathan earlier this week, if you listen to his January 10th program, he was talking about Joe Biden's dropping poll numbers among non-whites. So maybe this is, I don't know, maybe he's not as seen out as we think he is. Maybe he just knows no one's going to question him when he makes these statements. Certainly no one gathered at that church that day questioned him when he said that he started the civil rights movement. In fact, they clapped and cheered for him, as Babylon Bee put it, in their satirical headline of the situation, MAGA is a cult, says party doing chants for politician inside church. So, and who also, I guess, believed that their politician started the civil rights movement despite his history. You know, his redemption over the years for being a stolid Democrat who actually blocked the first African-American female justice from being considered, because that's what he did under the Bush administration. Joe Biden came out and said, you know what, the Republicans can't be the first to get a black woman in there, so I'm going to do everything in my power to block this person. He outright said he was blocking her based on the color of her skin and her gender. Rather racist and sexist of him, but that's the state of the party, you know, where all your past sins are forgiven. They just count on the media and the voters to do their work in burying the issues of the past. Gee whiz, I remember in 2016, the website for the Democratic National Committee, it said that for the past 200 years, they've been at the forefront of civil rights endeavors in this country. All right, it said that. 200 years they've been at the forefront of civil rights. That is glossing over a few things. For example, I'm not sure if the party even had existed for 200 years by the time of 2016, but I think it was still Democrat hyphen Republican at the time. But then compounding that is the fact that the first Democrat president, Andrew Jackson, you can ask the Seminoles what his position was on civil rights. They're going to tell you a good story about that. But then you can also ask, I guess, the folks in the Civil War what the Democrat Party's position on civil rights was. A lot of history was glossed over. In fact, less than 200 years ago, in 1924, the Ku Klux Klan basically took over the Democrat National Convention because the party was just so in bed with the Klan, so infiltrated by its members. In fact, one of the party members was, that's Senator Robert Byrd out of West Virginia. I forgot the exact rank that he had in the KKK, but it was a rank that you could only achieve by having recruited people to the Klan. And he opposed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, And then you have Nancy Pelosi come out and say, and at his eulogy, he was on the right side of every issue. I guess that included opposing civil rights in 1964. So the Democrat Party, they know their voters are rather low information, don't do the research, or they just think that voting is more of a virtue signal than anything else. So you just do what the party says, you ignore the party's past, you ignore history in general. In fact, you try to rewrite it. You knock over statues and all that, and you try, and this is where the state we get in, where Joe Biden could come out and say he started the civil rights movement, nobody bats an eyelash. The White House quietly scrubs the transcript and writes something that's more favorable in there. We all heard what he said, and the only people who seemed to care was the White House staff. Now, the average Democrat voter, I kind of wonder how they view this statement of his. On the one hand, do they actually believe it? Sure, why not? Because they believe everything else Joe Biden says, I suppose. Certainly they were mad about George Santos lying, therefore they should have been mad when Joe Biden lied, right? If they weren't hypocrites or anything like that, or if they didn't have the standard of it's wrong if the other side does it, but it's right if our side does it, whatever that item may be. So do they disbelieve him unquestionably? Or do they think that he is just so old, feeble, and senile that he can't even get through one speech without screwing up to such an extent that he says that he starts the civil rights movement? And they still don't care. They figure he's better than any alternative that the Republican Party has. And boy, isn't that a scary thought. I'm not even sure which is worse. Is it worse that they don't question his statements and they just believe everything he says? Or is it worse if they know that he is a doddering old fool and they're still going to vote for him anyway because they are just so terrified of the other side that they figure anything is better, including this guy who thinks he started the civil rights movement? It's a question you got to wonder that they've got to ask themselves. And you got to ask yourself, too, how did you get to this point where you believe this sort of thing? That you believe the other side is just that bad? Gee whiz, you have Whoopi Goldberg on The View. She comes out and says, oh, the other side, if Trump wins, he's going to put you in concentration camps. Like, what? No, that's what Democrats wanted. Rasmussen poll in 2022 showed that 45% of Democrats wanted concentration camps for the unvaccinated. So who's the real threat here, right? Which one of you guys, who's projecting here right now? And there's just this lack of self-awareness about this issue. They just feel that they are so in the right on everything that whatever the other side does is scary, and it doesn't matter if my side does it. It's fine when my side does it. It's scary when the other side does it. And there's just no sense of, I really shouldn't take this extreme measure, like believing everything Biden says or supporting him no matter what he says, or putting the other side of the aisle into concentration camps, because the other side of the aisle might in turn feel justified in radicalizing themselves and coming at me with that same extremism that I'm bringing to them. You know, there's no awareness of that. They just assume automatically they're going to be in power forever. And perhaps with the rigged elections and the like, that's the case. Meanwhile, what's their party doing to them? Massachusetts governor and lieutenant governor declare state of emergency over migrant crisis, ask residents to house illegal immigrants in their homes, headline from the Gateway Pundit. So you're not allowed guns, but here, take in this MS-13 gangster who illegally has a gun anyway, and is probably dosed up on so many drugs that he is completely unreasonable as a person, and just stick him in your house. You can't have a gun in your house, but you can have illegal immigrants. And I'm pretty sure, well, this comes into, which amendment is that? Is it the Third Amendment that's against quartering, or is it the Fourth that's quartering soldiers in your house? You know, you're not allowed to, the government's not allowed to force you to take in soldiers. Maybe that's kind of, maybe this kind of violates that amendment. You know, I don't remember what amendment it is. I think it's the Fourth. I don't remember specifically what amendment number it was, but I do remember that the only person so far in country's history that's been convicted or found guilty, well, found to have violated that amendment, was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, the father of, wait, not Andrew Cuomo, sorry, his father, the father of Chris Cuomo and Andrew Cuomo. He was also governor of New York, Cuomo Democrat, found guilty of violating that amendment. The only person who found guilty of violating that amendment of quartering soldiers in the House. But now you have the Massachusetts governor. Yeah, technically it could be quartering soldiers in your house. After all these illegal immigrants coming over, the majority of them are not scared women or children or anything like that. They're fighting age males who could easily be a foreign country soldiers. So perhaps we have the Massachusetts governor encouraging its citizens to quarter foreign soldiers in their homes. Isn't that nice? More Silker Joe Show after this break.
Kickstart the new year with Mario and friends on their latest adventure. Experience the next evolution of Mario fun with the Super Mario Bros. Wonder Game. Classic Mario side-scrolling gameplay is turned on its head with spectacular moments you have to see to believe, including unexpected events called Wonder Effects and the largest cast of characters in a side-scrolling Mario game, including Luigi, Peach, Daisy, Toad, and Yoshi. You can even buddy up on one system or play online with the Nintendo games rated E to E10+. Of a system that best fits their needs and playstyles. And if you're in the mood to play some of your all-time faves, the Nintendo Switch family of systems is home to Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, Animal Crossing New Horizons, The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, Splatoon 3, Pikmin 4, and more. For more, go to Nintendo.com. Additional game systems and or accessories may be required for multiplayer mode. Nintendo Switch Online membership and Nintendo account required for online features. Membership auto-renews after initial term at the then current price unless canceled. Not available in all countries. Internet access required for online features. Terms apply. Nintendo.com/Switch-Online. Game systems, some accessories, and Nintendo Switch Online membership sold separately. Games rated E to E10+.
So when we're setting up stuff for the new year, we've come in with a lot of energy. It's good to level set, take a step back, relax just a little bit, think about the small things that we can do, that we can fit into our life right now and do them very, very well. That's the key, sustainability. So I would start with using a tracking app. That way you know what you're bringing in and what you're bringing out. MyFitnessPal is a great option for that. It's going to help build sustainable habits over time. And to help with that, the nutritionists over at MyFitnessPal, along with Kate Hudson, have developed the Small Steps, Big Wins plan. This is a 7-day challenge that gives you the little steps that you need to build that foundation so you can meet your goals. You can go straight to the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store, download MyFitnessPal, and get started.
Hi, I'm Catherine Judah Chilo. I have three wonderful children with my husband, Sean, who I met on the 17th season of The Bachelor. At just 5 months old, our son, Isaiah, became sick and spent 4 days in the hospital. At first, my husband and I thought he had a common cold, but it turned out to be much more serious. It was respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. RSV is the number one reason why babies are hospitalized. I'm sharing my story so other parents can learn about the importance of helping protect their babies from RSV when they are most vulnerable to it. If you are pregnant or plan on becoming pregnant, speak to your OBGYN or healthcare provider about the risks of RSV. As a mother, I've seen a lot of warning labels, from choking hazards to baby toys, and I wish RSV came with one. To learn more, visit www.bewareofrsv.com. That's www.bewareofrsv.com. This message is brought to you by Pfizer.
What is dadication?
I am the father of a 9-year-old little girl and a 6-year-old little boy. And I find fatherhood both relentlessly challenging and relentlessly rewarding. My daughter is biological and my son is adopted. I love them both so much. From the morning when you wake up to putting them to bed at night, and every moment in between, it really is so special, and boy, is it exhausting. One thing that I fear about being a parent is the future for my children. I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings. But I'm also hopeful that the future holds a more inclusive and compassionate world for them.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show.
If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs, and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Welcome back to the Silker Joe Show, everybody. Thank you for sticking with us through this hour of the show. We are joined for this final segment by Dr. Dan McMillan. He leads Save Democracy in America, a strictly nonpartisan nonprofit organization that focuses on big money and politics. Dr. McMillan, happy to have you on the show again. How are you today?
Terrific. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you. So coming into 2024, and you know, we've certainly seen the need for big money in politics, especially this election cycle. But you know, it seems to be kind of alienating people who may not have enough money, because it seems like campaign success isn't judged by charisma or whether or not the people actually would want to hear your message. It seems more like how much dollars you spend on the campaign. And that seemed to be the case sitting here in Virginia for this previous election in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, it's you know, it's been true for a while, that quite some time, actually for decades, that you can't mount a credible campaign without a lot of money. But the cost of the federal campaigns has fairly skyrocketed in the last, you know, 7-8 years. The federal campaigns doubled from 2016 to 2020, for example, and now it's gotten to the point where it's hard to see how our representatives in Washington have time to do much else than fundraise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the astronomical sums of money they need to bring in, and we just seem to be in this, we have like a campaign industrial complex and a 24/7, 365 campaign at this point, even for elections that are years in the future.
Yeah, no, that's true. And in a lot of ways, you know, the real action in any campaign takes place the year before the campaign year, when the candidates behind the scenes are jockeying for position among donors and seeing who can be most attractive to donors and raise the most money. The political scientists actually call that the invisible primary. But what that basically means is that any candidate or any idea that a candidate has that's not attractive or even not interesting to donors just sort of dies off out of sight, out of mind, and we never hear about them. So that, in effect, the donors, by default, choose the candidates we're allowed to vote for and what those candidates can do once they're in office. I mean, it's not a conspiracy, but it's just if you don't really are very attractive to donors, then your campaign never gets off the ground and the public never hears your name.
Hmm. And maybe that's part of what ended up being the thrust behind Donald Trump or Vivek Ramaswamy or RFK Jr. or Bernie Sanders. Just this, they didn't seem to have this sort of corporate backing or mainstream party backing. They seem to be out on their own and quite willing to state their own views as opposed to the views of their donors.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, President Trump's success in 16 and again in this year, and also the success that Bernie Sanders has had, I think a lot of that comes from the perception by the voters on both sides of the aisle that these candidates are outsiders running at least to some degree against the system. I mean, I'm not endorsing either candidate or saying that they really would bring the change that we need, but I think that the success of candidates like Trump and Sanders shows that the American people really want some kind of fundamental change. It's just that no one who works in politics has any good incentive to explain to the voters that money is really what broke the system and what has robbed them of their voice in their own government.
Mm-hmm. And there's certainly no incentive to fix it. I mean, money is the ultimate incentive, and all the money goes against fixing the broken system.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, for one thing, the current system of campaign finance makes it almost impossible to challenge an incumbent, because someone who's in Congress right now is in a position to do favors for you now, today. And so incumbents always outraise their challengers massively. So that's another thing that's wrong with the system, and another reason I think why the American people are understandably very alienated from the system.
Yeah, well, we see this sort of playing out with the Democrat primary, how Joe Biden, he's not particularly popular with their voters, but because he is the incumbent, you know, other challengers, like, I forgot the congressman's name, or the aforementioned RFK Jr., or Marianne Williamson, well, they're just out of luck, because they don't have the backing of those big donors, because their guy is in, they figure, well, he's in already, he can win again.
Yeah, in effect, the Democratic Party establishment, the donor class, and all the other candidates, sort of leading Democratic candidates who might have challenged Biden for the nomination this cycle, have kind of all agreed in some way. I mean, I don't know if it was a single conference call or if it was just back and forth or everyone just sort of understood. They agreed, I think, already by the beginning of last year or even sometime the year before that there was going to be a Biden-Harris coronation. And yet something like 70% of Democratic voters today, although they certainly don't want Donald Trump in the White House, they're very unhappy with Biden being their only choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and alienation works on the other side, too. We're just not seeing it quite this year, but, you know, it's been in the past. There's been plenty of times where Republicans, they have a loser in the White House or in whatever other office, and there's just no viable alternative. You know, Mitch McConnell, I don't think he's been particularly popular, but you're not going to see his replacement anytime soon because he is just the darling of the donors. The bell of the ball, so to speak. So that really both sides are severely impacted by this, but like we said, neither side really has incentive to fix it. What can the public really do about it?
Well, the only way really to fix this system, the only way to change the game that the Supreme Court will let us do, will not strike down, is public financing. And that's kind of the system that I fight for, called voter dollars. That is to say, make the voters the donors. Have the government give every registered voter an allotment of campaign cash that you can give to candidates, and that way there's an alternative pool of money so that candidates who want to serve us can get the cash they need from us instead of from industry or labor unions or billionaires and so on. And that's really the only path to fixing it.
I have seen there was a Democrat congressman, I think he was out of Kentucky, like 3 years, or gosh, it's been that long, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I saw that he had some proposals about this sort of thing. But the trouble is, though, that like the government ultimately dictated who could run and who would get the money. So if the government didn't like the candidate, oh, well, that person's not going to get your voter dollars.
You're really picking up on something very, very important, Joe. Thank you. Because there are other public financing mechanisms like lump sum grants to candidates or government matching donations to smaller candidates. The genius of the voter dollar system is that the decision who gets the money is decentralized to 168 million registered voters.
All right, well, I'll have to end it there because we're out of time for this program. But Dr. Dan McMillan, appreciate you being on the Silker Joe Show. And listeners, he is with Save Democracy in America. So just Google Dr. McMillan, Save Democracy in America, if you want to learn more. And our website, MainStreetRadioNetwork.com. Be seeing you.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, MainStreetRadioNetwork.com.